It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, you may only know Wisconsin life from Wisconsin Public Radio, but it's also a staple on Wisconsin Public Television. We'll get a sneak peek of their new season. First, Governor Walker announced the state's proposed transportation budget last week, allocating $605 million for county and state road maintenance and another $65 million for local government projects. While some people approve the plan, others have worried that the plan doesn't go far enough to provide a long-term transportation fix for Wisconsin. Joining us now to talk about that plan is Craig Thompson. He's the executive director of the Transportation Development Association. Craig, welcome back.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, transportation in Wisconsin, this isn't an easy fix. What do you like about the plan?
Well, I guess what we do like about the plan is that there is some recognition of local roads, local government's needs and keeping up their roads, and there is a bump in funding for them for that purpose.
And what about sticking points, things that you think could be stronger?
Well, the overall transportation budget is reduced. Heading into this budget, the Fiscal Bureau said we've got a $940 million deficit. And this budget proposal does nothing on the revenue side to try to address that. But what it does do is drastically reduces funding for basically any interstate project other than the zoo interchange, which is going to make those last much, much longer, and major highway projects as well, like the Verona Road interchange in Dane County. So from our standpoint, it's not really a plan as much as it is a way to maybe get through 2 years, and then it's kind of we'll see what we'll do after that.
So you see this as a plan that more or less kicks the football down the road.
Yeah, it really does, and even more than that, I'd say the last three budgets have kicked the can down the road. This one actually would, if we adopted it as is, would set us back even further.
In terms of what you would like to see instead, some options on the table have been things like the gas tax, for instance. What do you think about options like those that didn't make it into the plan?
Well, we really have two user fees that go into that fund transportation right now in Wisconsin. That is the gas tax we pay when we fill up our car, and it's the registration fee we pay when we get our sticker. We pay $75. So from our standpoint, those user fees have been how we have funded transportation, and adjusting those, I think, would make the most sense for how we would get ourselves on a sustainable path that we can get projects on a known schedule and still fund local governments.
What do you think of the governor's choice not to do that? What do you think is behind that?
Well, I think there's a desire to say that we haven't raised any fees or taxes, and I can appreciate that, but I think it's drastically going to increase costs in particularly the southeastern part of the state, and I think it's going to increase the amount that we're going to be driving through orange barrels because unlike the DOT's plan last time around, which was to get in, fix it, and get out, I think we're going to be constantly repaving stretches of interstate that are 60-plus years old.
Now, another option that was under consideration, not officially, but some people have been calling for it, was a look at toll roads in Wisconsin, some sort of bigger fixes like that might be more dramatic. What do you think about options like those?
Well, the last budget did put in some funding to do a study for feasibility on that, and I believe HNTB Corporation is conducting that, and it should be done soon. But right now, there is a federal prohibition on tolling existing interstate lanes. So until there's a change from the feds, we could either toll non-interstate lanes, which there probably isn't the volume to do that, or we could toll an additional lane if we add a lane.
Right now, we're speaking with Craig Thompson, Executive Director of the Transportation Development Association, looking at the state's proposed transportation budget right now. And in terms of that $65 million we mentioned to go to projects by local governments, and you said that's something that you think is a good thing. What do you think is needed about directing the funding there?
Well, if you look at the counties and cities are on a share of cost model, and they used to be 20 years ago or so get about 30% of their costs reimbursed. They're down to about 14% now. And the towns are on a rate per mile, and that's gone down significantly as well. So what we've been seeing is a lot of proposals for wheel taxes or exceeding the property tax limits or bonding more at the local level to try to just keep up with the local roads. So an increase in aids from the state to the locals, I think, is very much welcomed, and it's something that we have asked for. So that portion, we're very supportive of. But if the only way we're going to come up with that is to stop all movement forward on the interstate program, we don't think that's a very sustainable way to go about it.
And you've said that there are specific economic corridors that you're concerned about under this plan. Are there areas that you look at and you do feel that there's going to be some concern if there isn't some attention paid to those roads and that infrastructure?
Yeah, so a couple of the projects that would be, you could either say delayed or just indefinitely put on hold right now, are the I-94 in Racine County between Kenosha and Milwaukee. So the part in Kenosha has been done, and there's 8 lanes there now, and it's new, and there's been quite a bit of economic activity, and the part up into Milwaukee is done, but you've got this sort of donut hole in the middle in Racine that has been languishing. That's on no schedule at all right now. Then you've got the east-west, which is right in front of Miller Park, that's in between the Zoo Interchange and the Marquette, which will be done. That is postponed, as well as I-43 north of Milwaukee, the 894 bypass, and the rest of the Zoo Interchange, the north leg. So those are all components of the interstate system down there that would be put on hold.
What are you hearing from taxpayers about how they'd like to handle transportation funding?
You know, like with any question like this, you get mixed responses. The last Marquette poll asked people what they would like, and 44% said that they would prefer to pay an increased fee or tax to get these things moving, and 33% said to just postpone projects. So, you know, I think there's more and more folks that are saying they'd rather pay a little bit more and get these things done and get things moving, but, you know, it's not unanimous.
If you're looking at the question of it being an either-or situation with local roads versus interstates, and right now that money seems to be going to these local roads, is that the right choice, do you think?
Well, again, I just don't think you can say it's an either-or, and I think the reaction you've seen from a lot of local governments around the state has been sort of saying that they desperately need some more funding from the state, and it's appreciated, but it really is an entire system. The locals generally constitute the first and last mile, which is extremely important in an agriculture state and a manufacturing state. But if we're going to allow some of the other main areas to fall apart, then it just doesn't work. We can't do one at the expense of the other.
Are there areas that you think could create user danger because the infrastructure is just getting that old?
There's several areas that we are concerned about that the federal government has said are outdated. Are that old? You've got left-hand off ramps that are dangerous. And the most specific area, I think, is Highway 23 between Fond du Lac and Sheboygan, which has had too many fatalities over the last 2 years. And this budget would delay that project for 3 more years. And I know the folks in Fond du Lac and Sheboygan are very upset about that.
No, not to create a false equivalency here, but some people might take the stance that there are issues in the state that are maybe more deserving of funding, that are more urgent, for instance, maybe money for schools. What kind of case would you make for transportation?
Well, again, whether it's schools or health care or UW, those are all in the general fund budget and all exceedingly important to our quality of life. We have a separate budget for transportation that we have user fees go into in the form of gas tax and registration fees, and we believe that's why we should adjust those user fees rather than go and try to take additional money out of the general fund that has to fund other important needs. So I think there's a lot of important debates to have on the general fund side, but for transportation there's a separate budget. It's constitutionally separate, and there are separate user fees that go into that, and we think we should adjust those to deal with transportation, which is a pretty core function of government.
And will your group be lobbying lawmakers to try to make some of those changes to the plan?
With us, we are registered and we will be talking with legislators, but our primary mission is advocacy and providing information and dealing with the policymakers and the public about just what their decisions will mean.
And we leave it there. Craig, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was Craig Thompson, Executive Director of the Transportation Development Association. He joined us to talk about the state's proposed transportation budget. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, loneliness comes with a surprising group of negative health outcomes. We'll find out why and what can be done to help people going through lonely times in their lives. First, we feature Wisconsin Life segments every Monday and Wednesday here on Central Time. But what you may not know is that there's a companion program that airs on Wisconsin Public Television, and the fourth season will premiere this Thursday. Trevor Keller is with us now to give us a preview of that new season. He's a producer for Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. Trevor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what's different in this fourth season of Wisconsin Life?
Well, I don't know if I'd say different. I think we're always looking for unusual, interesting stories around Wisconsin. We try to cover every corner of the state and try to tell a variety of stories from sports to arts to culture to science, nature, and everything in between. So I think we just try to cover a nice diversity of stories.
And how do you find the stories that you cover?
Well, a wide range of. We have people email us. We look on our own. We read, you know, magazine articles, newspapers. We just meet people out in the community. A wide variety. We're always looking for story ideas. And you can always go on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and submit story ideas as well. But we're always looking, you know, online, meeting people in person, everything in between, really.
And I suppose as a producer for Wisconsin Life, you get to see firsthand a lot of things about the state that might surprise you. Did you have a lot of those this time around, things that you thought, gosh, I didn't know that that was a thing that happened here in Wisconsin?
I think most of the time. I mean, sometimes you do go into it with an idea where, oh, maybe I would like to find somebody who does X, Y, or Z, and then you find them, and maybe they do that thing even better than you expected. But I think most of the time, you're just impressed at the skill and dedication it takes to do whatever it is the person may be doing.
And a lot of the people in the show are, you know, what you might call real people. They're not professionals in the media. They're not used to probably being in front of a camera. So what do you do to put people at ease and just help them relax into telling their story and sharing their lives with you?
Well, we try really hard to not think of it as a TV production. At least I don't. I try to approach it, you know, you just talk to people like you would talk to a normal person and try not to focus on the fact that there's a camera there or a microphone or anything of that nature. And you just try to approach it like a conversation. And usually most of the subjects we have are, you know, pretty personable and excited to talk about whatever it is we're there to talk with them about.
Well, we're going to listen to some clips from the show, but I wonder if before we dive into that, if you could just give us a little primer on some of the variety, the different things that we'll find in this complete season.
Yeah, well, when the season starts on Thursday, our first episode, one of the stories I did is about a sculptor named Brian Berenson, and he sculpts wood and stone carvings, but what's really interesting is he also works with an Austrian Mardi Gras group in Milwaukee, and so during Mardi Gras season in January to Easter, they perform around Milwaukee, and what they do is they wear these almost creepy, scary wooden masks, and they do this series of dances. They play at all these like German-themed events around Milwaukee, and so Brian is the sculptor for those dancers, and so being able to go into his shop and see him work and do what he does is really fascinating.
And what else have you got?
Well, we have a story about a team of students from UW-Barron County, which is up north of Eau Claire, and they built a Rube Goldberg machine. I don't know if you know what a Rube Goldberg machine is.
Refresh us.
Yeah, it's kind of like the board game Mousetrap. And so you're trying to do a series of steps to create or to solve a simple task. And so what these students did is they built a Rube Goldberg machine that paid homage to Nikola Tesla, and they took it to the national competition in Columbus, Ohio, which is what they have every year. And I won't say how they did, but they did very well. And for them, it was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So it was really fun to see them go through the process and how they achieved what they did.
And we've got a clip of that. Let's take a listen.
We're kind of a low budget operation, so we used our family Explorer and my husband's ice shack.
And drove all the way down to Columbus, Ohio.
That's how everyone knew we were from Wisconsin.
Yep.
No one else pulled up in the ice shack.
It quickly became apparent they were in the big leagues now.
So we were up against the big dogs in the engineering world. There were two teams from Penn State. There were three teams from Purdue, University of Texas, University of Tennessee, Arizona State University.
All these other big engineering schools that have, you know, put thousands and thousands of dollars into their machines.
And I think we had about a tool case full of hand tools.
At a theater shop.
And that's from a clip from a Wisconsin team participating in a Rube Goldberg competition. That must have been a really fun story to shoot. What was their machine like?
Well, it was 45 steps, and they kept it very basic. So it was like a marble going down a tube and then kind of knocking another device over, which knocks another device over. And eventually it comes around to where there's two RC race cars, and they race around the bottom of the track or the bottom of the machine. And then they knock over a wall, which opens an umbrella. And they had like almost like a life-size replica of Nikola Tesla sitting on one edge of the machine, and it's holding an umbrella, which is what the task was for that year's competition, was to open an umbrella. So when it goes through the 45 steps, which happens in about 45 seconds, so it's very fast. So if you aren't paying attention, you'll miss it. But it was very fun to see, and it was interesting to see the amount of work that went into it and the fact that, like they mentioned in the clip, they didn't have a lot of money. Like some of the other teams that they faced in this competition had thousands of dollars and sponsors and all this stuff, and they basically had some pieces of wood, some tools, and a theater shop to build it in.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool. So that one is, what is that one airing?
I don't think we have a specific air date. It's later in the season. I think it'll be in November, but don't quote me on that.
Well, we're talking about the new season of Wisconsin Life. It airs at 7 o'clock on Thursdays on Wisconsin Public Television. And Trevor Keller is with us. He's a producer on the Wisconsin Public Television version of Wisconsin Life. And you mentioned that mask maker, Trevor, and we have a little bit of audio from that particular episode as well, and let's listen to that.
I was diagnosed with arthritis when I was 21 years old. I was a diesel mechanic, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I was literally crawling on my knees. And so my wife and I decided to take a vacation over in Austria to check out this school that we read about in a magazine. A wood carving school. And so I learned how to do this over in Austria and brought it with me here to America. If I was a perfectly healthy person, you know, I could just probably go at it all day long. I can't stand too long and I can't sit too long. So I do a combination of the two, and it seems to work out.
Nice. So he's dealing with some arthritis in the hands there, it sounds like, but it sounds like it's something he's doing a labor of love and doing amazing creative work anyway. Can you describe what these masks look like?
It's pretty hard unless you see them, but it's a lot of them are, they're just almost cartoonish faces, and sometimes they have misshapen features, and they're supposed to be creepy. And the idea is when they perform in this Mardi Gras club, the dances are supposed to scare away winter. So that's why they're scary. So even though they are scary, people seem to have fun when you go to one of these events where they're dancing. It seems to be fun, and everybody gets out and dances and has a good time. And so the idea is basically it's based off the Austrian traditions where they try to scare away winter.
Nice. Well, that sounds like a good idea here in Wisconsin. Let's talk about another one that you've told us you're doing. This is a program, creative program for veterans who are living with PTSD. Set this one up a little bit. What's in this one?
Yeah, this was a really amazing story to work on. It takes place at the Milwaukee VA Hospital, and it's called Feast of Crispian, and it's based off Shakespeare. And what it is there's these three actors who run this program, and one of them, I think two of them have a therapy background. And so what they basically do are weekend workshops where they bring in veterans from the VA who have either PTSD, addiction issues, other issues that they're just facing in their lives. And they basically run them through 3-day Shakespeare intensives. And so it's like acting. It's not just classes, but they actually act out scenes, and they do it kind of in short bits to kind of help these veterans who don't have much experience acting. And it was really, I can't even really describe how amazing this was to see in person. You kind of don't know what to expect when you go into a situation like this. Oh, we have veterans who have never acted before. What's this going to be like? But it was a very moving experience to see in person.
Here's a little taste of that one.
There are three of us that are the founders of Feast of Crispian. All of us are professional actors. The main part of our program is that we put them through Shakespeare scenes, and we have special techniques. One of us stands at their shoulder and reads a half a line or a full line to them, and then they can repeat it back in any way they want.
I shall be glad to learn of noble men. I shall be glad to learn of noble men.
It's almost like a guide. You know what I mean? A Jiminy Cricket in your ear. But I do love thee.
But I do love thee.
We're thinking about it in terms of giving them some kind of emotional pop.
Oh, that sounds pretty extraordinary. Do you have a sense at all from having spent some time with this creative program why this Shakespeare works, what he channels?
Well, I think part of it is that the language does speak a lot in emotion. There's a lot of emotion in Shakespeare. But also part of it is I think it allows them, and Nancy Smith Watson, who's the director of the program, whose voice you heard there, she speaks to this in the piece, that it allows them to express their emotions without directly expressing their emotions. And especially when you've had something like PTSD, a lot of these folks come in, they haven't expressed their emotions in a long time, or they're repressing their emotions. So this allows them to emote and express their emotions in a way without actually sitting down and saying, oh, I feel this way, or oh, I have this rage or this love or whatever it is I cannot get out of me. This kind of allows them an outlet. And so it's amazing because I spent 3 days with them, and from start to finish, it was amazing seeing some of these veterans come in kind of shy, backward, and by the end, they're out there just letting it rip out on the floor, fully into the roles that they were playing.
Oh, I can't wait for that one. That sounds great. And finally, I know you well, there's a lot of things you look at, but you also told us about the Rubik's Cube record holder in Wanakee.
Yeah, there's a young man in Wanakee, and this is one where I've always been interested in the Rubik's Cube. For the record, I'm not any good at the Rubik's Cube, but I found a kid, and he can do a Rubik's Cube in 9 to 11 seconds. He averages about 10 seconds a go-around.
9 to 11 seconds.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to see in person. Wow. And he can also do it with his feet. He can do it blindfolded, all of the above. Like, it's really an amazing story.
Wow, and how does he use that skill?
Right now, just entering competitions around the country, which he does, and he does very well in. And he enters competitions around the country and competes and just kind of uses it as a fun thing to do in his free time.
Well, Trevor, we're looking forward. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Trevor Keller, producer of Wisconsin Life, and he joined us there to talk about the new season, which starts this Thursday at 7 o'clock. And you can check your local Wisconsin Public Television listings for other times and other information. And we also have a link to the show's website on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll find out why our guest says loneliness is a public health issue and it's time to start taking it seriously. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the EPA is trying to restrict a weed killer that might be linked to birth defects and cancer. We hear why some farm groups are pushing back against the potential regulation. First, growing research is indicating that loneliness may be linked to a host of health problems, including functional and cognitive decline and increased risk of heart disease and stroke. It's also a four-letter word in Western society that people can be ashamed to talk about. But our next guest says it's time to start taking loneliness for what it is, a public health problem that's hitting older adults especially hard. Carla Parisinotto joins us now. She's a geriatrician specializing in the care of older adults, and she began studying loneliness when she realized that there were other factors affecting her patients' health that weren't routinely being looked at in the medical field. Dr. Parisinotto, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when did you first realize that it was time to start taking loneliness more seriously?
You know, it was probably during my residency training in late 2010, probably, that, you know, I had been taking care of older adults and realizing that, you know, we focus so much on medicine, on blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes, and I was realizing that some of my patients weren't getting better despite controlling these things, and it made me think, you know, what else are we missing here? And so many of my older patients start to go through life transitions, you know, not working, loss of a spouse, et cetera, that I started thinking, you know, could there be things such as isolation and loneliness that are affecting them? And that's really how it started.
And did they share that with you, or was there reluctance at first to start talking about that?
There's absolutely a reluctance, I think, in a general sense. In general, anything related to mental health and personal feelings sometimes is still stigmatized, unfortunately, and so many people still feel uncomfortable talking about it. But what I found in my own practice is that when I started bringing up the topic, there were more people that I could imagine that were actually stating that they felt lonely. Even this weekend, I gave a talk in the community in San Francisco, and people in the audience, once they heard the topic, all of a sudden you hear these hands go up and saying, well, I feel lonely even though I'm married, or I live with my children and I still feel lonely. So I think once the conversation is opened, suddenly you start realizing that it's a bigger problem than we realize.
Well, that's really interesting that people are sharing stories of being lonely among other people. So then as a healthcare provider, you have to wonder, well, what do we do about this? You can't just give people someone to talk to and it's going to cure everything.
That's exactly right. And I think that's such an important point that I bring up with my patients. And even when I teach about this topic, or as I start to look at interventions and options, is that, you know, in my own research that I did, that more than half of people who reported feeling lonely were actually married. So again, showing that this is a complex problem, and that you're exactly right. It's not as easy as saying, telling someone, well, just go to a senior center. That may work for some people, but it's trying to figure out at the individual level, what is the lack in social relationship for that person, and how can we work with that person? So there's certainly, I think going forward, it's looking at what interventions on a greater scale do we have a general sense of knowing that they'll work, but then individualizing the treatment to say, okay, for this one person who I'm seeing, I know that what they really love is bridge, and they miss that. So how can I get them connected to that? So those are the different types of things to figure out. How can we reconnect people with other people, which, frankly, is changing a lot these days with technology, for good or bad.
And you mentioned that some of these people, you know, they were married and they were still lonely. So it makes me wonder, what is the opposite of lonely? Do we know?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, I wish I knew, but it's probably people that do feel connected most of the time. And I would say that, you know, loneliness, I think in a general sense, when you ask questions, there are people that may feel it here and there. But it's when you start feeling this on more days than not and more often than not that it really becomes a bigger problem. But I think the opposite sense is really truly someone who's feeling connected in different ways. But again, it's going to be a variable by person, what that connection means and what that signifies.
And we touched a little on some of the health consequences that seem to be linked to loneliness. And tell us from your experience working with people what you see that you think loneliness might be a contributor to when it comes to some of these negative healthcare outcomes.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think, you know, from my perspective as a geriatrician, one of the things that I care about the most and one of the things that my patients care the most about is maintaining independence and preserving function. So from a healthcare perspective, for me and what I see in my patients is that loneliness is, increases their risk of losing their independence. And ultimately, that has huge impact on someone's quality of life, and it actually has a lot of impact on healthcare dollars because of increased need for equipment or potential risk for nursing home admission. And then in other research, there's more specific risks, such as increased risk of heart problems, increased risk of death from my own research. And we're starting to see a lot more as this problem is starting to take more be taken more seriously and realizing that it's not something to be ignored.
We're talking with Dr. Carla Parisinotto right now. She's an associate professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and she specializes in the care of older adults, and she's also studied loneliness as an overlooked factor in patients' health. And we've been talking, Dr. Parisinotto, about older people, older adults here, but loneliness isn't something that specifically afflicts one age group. I imagine once you start looking, you'll see loneliness across the board.
That's exactly right, and I think I'm not as familiar with the research in younger adults, but certainly one of the questions we have as researchers is trying to figure out, we know that there's an increased risk of loneliness as we get older, but there are certainly people that have the risk younger or earlier in life, or there may be some folks that have an experience of quote-unquote chronic loneliness throughout their whole life. And I think some areas where we're looking for and need more answers is there a difference with this from this chronic loneliness across the lifespan versus episodic, something that comes and goes? And those are certainly some questions that we need answered that, you know, I'm hoping to be able to research in the future. The challenge, you know, is finding the research money to support this. And I'm hoping that as this becomes more of a truly public health problem that people are aware of, it will increase the probability that people will want to fund this type of research.
And I suppose being alone is unavoidable in life. Everyone is going to be alone at some point or another in their life, most likely. Do we know if there are ways to be alone, to be by yourself, that are nourishing and not necessarily lonely times?
Absolutely, and I think that is a great comment, and actually important to distinguish is that, you know, you can be alone and not feel lonely. You can just have one friend and not feel lonely, but it's for that individual person, what is the type of connection that they're missing or not missing that would make them feel lonely or not lonely? But still, it's about how you feel connected. Some people are perfectly fine being alone. And some of the upcoming research is really looking at kind of psychological or cognitive reserve to deal with some of these stressors of the loss of relationships or change in relationships as a coping mechanism.
So you've talked to a lot of your patients about that. What did they tell you about what happens in a life that makes it more lonely?
I think that there's, one, it's very humbling because there are times that I have forgotten to ask, and I feel very humbled when my patients have started telling me about this since it's getting more attention, so that's great. But I think a big part is, unfortunately, in our country, we still, and perhaps throughout the world, but I think more accentuated in the United States, is that there's still a great deal of ageism, such that some folks, as they get older, feel like they're becoming irrelevant and they're not sure how to belong and where their place in society is, perhaps especially with the changes in retirement and, you know, the loss of a spouse is certainly a big one, or even caregiving for a spouse who may have cognitive impairment. So those are probably some of the biggest things that I'm seeing amongst my patients. But, you know, I have a woman I talk about sometimes who said she used to love working in retail. And when she retired, that was a big change in her social circle and really what was making her feel lonely. So we actually worked together to find a place for her to volunteer doing some retail at a local, just local store. And so that was really fulfilling for her and actually made a big, big difference in her feelings of loneliness. So that's the kind of the individualized interventions that you have to do once in a while.
So it is an individual thing, right? You can't just write out a prescription that takes away loneliness. You probably have to figure out what it is for each person that's going to connect them.
I think that's right. That being said, I think similarly to how we treat blood pressure, there may be five different medications that you know can work, and it's trying to figure out which one, but it's knowing which ones are going to work or what their options are that are first, which is why, you know, going forward, we need large-scale studies to look at different types of interventions to have a sense. Well, in general, we know, let's say, phone support systems like the Silver Line in the United Kingdom will work, but then it's trying to figure out for that individual person, is that the right intervention? So it's a little bit of both, finding large-scale proof, but then individualizing, which really is what medicine is coming to these days, is moving the evidence-based medicine into individualized care and care that's patient-centered, that a person says, this is how I want my health care to be moving forward.
And you mentioned that Silver Line, it was a hotline in England, I guess, where people can call up and just talk
exactly
if they're feeling lonely. Do we have anything like that here?
So we do. There is a, you know, and nationally, it's plus or minus where things are. We have a hotline here in San Francisco called the Friendship Line, which is specifically for older adults, which is very exciting. And interestingly, it's become so popular that we get calls or they get calls from across the United States at times as well. And what's exciting about that program is that, it's specific towards older adults, and people can call it any time. Or for people who live locally, what some of the volunteers do will arrange and say, for Miss Smith, I'm going to call her every Wednesday to check in. And it's a way to make sure that someone's still there, that they're healthy, that they're feeling connected, and so that they're not feeling marginalized and ignored.
Dr. Carla Parisinoto stays with us. She is an associate professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and she specializes in the care of older adults, and she looks particularly these days at loneliness as sometimes an overlooked factor in her patients' health. And we want to know what you think. Why do you think loneliness can be so hard to talk about? And why have we not looked at it more carefully as a component of good health, maybe until now? And do you think it does? Has it impacted your health, being lonely maybe, or maybe the health of a loved one and an older family member? And what do you think we can do to open up dialogue about loneliness, especially among older adults? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Dr. Carla Parisinotto is with us. She works with older adults at the University of California, San Francisco, and one of her specialties is taking a look at loneliness as an overlooked factor in patients' overall health. By some measures, there is an epidemic of loneliness going on, and it does seem to hit older adults especially hard, but it can be felt by anybody at any age, at any time in their life. And we want to know what you think. Have you gone through a particularly lonely time in your life? Did you come out of it? What did you do? And how did you help yourself connect again? Or is there an older family member who you think may be lonely now? What can we do to reach out to people and open up this dialogue about loneliness? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Joseph with us in Madison. Joseph, hi.
Hello. Yes, I started listening to the program. Interesting, because it's something that I've dealt with for years. I'm 62 years old now. I think that the first time I really started feeling extremely lonely was when I was about 4. Mm. And I look back and I think that, you know, maybe that had something to do with the divorce of my mother and father, which back in that day was not common. But ever since then, as I, you know, went through high school, I was very popular. I had a lot of friends, you know, and it was in sports, and I but I was always very, very lonely when it came down to it. I remember walking down the street when I was probably in my early 20s, just walking down the street and just crying. I was just extremely lonely. I don't know how to explain it, but lonely, you know, definitely has a part and has had a part in my life. I have a full family now. I have 5 children, but it's odd that I still experience a almost like an aloneness that I wish wasn't there. Mm. I kind of remove myself. I wish I didn't do that, but I don't know how to keep myself around the others that I'm with. So that's my experience. It's something that I know a lot about. I've experienced it for years.
Joseph, thank you so much for sharing that. You really painted a portrait of your life and what you've been going through, and also busting some myths that you can have a full family around you, 5 children, and still feel this separateness, this aloneness. And Dr. Parisinotto, where would you start with Joseph?
Yeah, no, I would say, Joseph, thank you for sharing your story. And I think hearing things like what you've experienced are important for everyone to hear about. I think so people realize they're, it's funny to say, but not alone in these feelings, and that other people feel this way too. And exactly, even with a fulfilling life with this, that's important to acknowledge, that it can be even when you have a family and friends. I would say, you know, it's worth delving into a little bit further with your physician or healthcare provider, anyone else you trust, to see are there different things that you should be doing that you think that would help you to connect. You know, one of the things in the psychological literature are how do we build our resilience towards these feelings? And I don't have the answers, because this is an area that we're still working on. But again, I think the more we start opening up this discussion, we're moving the conversation forward and hoping that, you know, we can potentially find things for people like you that could help ameliorate those feelings that can be quite distressful.
Well, Joseph, thank you. I'm really glad that you called and shared that today. And we'll go next to Megan in Cambridge. Megan, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I had a question. I'm a caregiver, and I'm also a social work major. And I work with older adults. And I found that in the process of when they get Alzheimer's, usually very prominently, it seems like the care tapers off from involving them in community.
Yep. Yep.
It's unfortunate because I found that a lot of them do hunger for community. Like, you can tell in their conversation.
Megan.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. No, that's a really great comment, and thank you so much for sharing that. And I think one of the things that we know in cognitive impairment in terms of development of dementia, one of the things that can be protective is actually socialization. So it kind of goes both ways in terms of helping to prevent the dementia, the Alzheimer's, from starting. But you're absolutely right. It's this lack of integration of folks with dementia into the rest of the community. And, you know, underlying this, our treatment of older adults, whether with loneliness or with other things, is how do we view older adults in our society, and are we integrating them, are we marginalizing them, and are we contributing to feelings of loneliness by not focusing or creating a focus on the care of older adults and integration in society?
And there's more to talk about there, and I thank you so much for your call, Megan. I want to make sure we get to our next caller. We're going to go to Eric in Madison. Eric, hi. Are you there?
Yep. Yeah, I'm here. Hi. Yeah, so I actually work at this place called Solstice House, which is in Madison. And we have a warm line, which is like a hotline, but people can call and pretty much talk about anything they need support with. And we serve all of Wisconsin, actually. So,
okay, so it's called a warm line, Eric, and anyone can call and talk about anything. Can you share the number with us?
Yeah. The number is area code 608-244-5077. So,
608-244-5077 is the number for the warm line. And
yeah,
Eric, have you had some good conversations there?
People generally seem to having a place to talk with, and we're open 24/7 every day of the year too. So, definitely had some interesting conversations, and there have been some people who've maybe not had much other support, and so, but.
Great. Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us, Eric. Appreciate that. And we've got that number. We'll go next to Mary for another call, a quick call maybe in West Bend. Mary, hi.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I have been dealing with cancer, and my family has just won't interact with me at all since I've had cancer. And my friends, and I don't talk about the cancer to make them uncomfortable, and I've never asked my family for anything. They're very wealthy, and they have time, although cancer and disease, like old age, I believe, makes people feel very uncomfortable, and it has nothing to do with the patient. It has to do with their comfort level. When they're very wealthy and living in a bubble, they don't want to see somebody who has, you know, maybe my hair falling out or dark circles under my eyes, or I can't walk maybe in a day, or, you know, I'm skinny.
Mary, thank you. And I want to jump in so we can make sure to get Dr. Parasinota's response to you. And I thank you for calling and sharing. And I'm sorry for what you're going through with your illness and your family. And I wish you well. And Dr. Parasinota, what would you say to Mary about being isolated like that when she is going through a difficult time and could use that support?
Yeah, no, it's so hard to hear that experience. But I think, as she's already saying, it's not about the patient in this case. It's about the families and our society's ability to cope with some of these difficult situations. It's you know, that's unfortunately a really challenging thing as we face our own mortality and our own fears about illness. And I think that's one of the reasons why, for example, people feel afraid to talk about loneliness, because for some it may feel too close, or it's the fear of not knowing how to respond. And again, by having these open conversations like you're holding on your show today, it's trying to create a safer environment to start talking about this so that it is more normalized in a sense, and not saying that it's normal, but that it's okay to talk about and that you should be getting support. And I would urge you, mm-hmm. though it's not your family, to think about if it works for you, to think about the different cancer support networks that are around. But clearly, it doesn't always supplement family, but it may be a thing.
And we're out of time, Dr. Parasinoto. Thank you for joining us. That was Carla Parasinoto, geriatrician and associate professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. You're listening to Central Time. Some tough news in the love department today. The CDC says salmonella outbreaks are on the rise, and part of the reason is that people are keeping backyard chickens, and it turns out a lot of people are cuddling their chickens and even kissing their chickens, and it might be making them sick. And also a lot of people are letting their chickens into the house instead of keeping them outside in the coop. And back to that kissing thing, I guess people are saying, well, baby chicks are really cute and people find it hard not to kiss them. Probably that's the case with kids. Well, the CDC has some advice. They say knock it off, enjoy the eggs, and minimize contact with those chickens. And another kind of sad news today, Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt getting divorced. And the gods of celebrity love not very happy. There was a minor earthquake near Los Angeles about 2 minutes after the news broke. Reading a little bit about it on Twitter, it couldn't help it. But there was a great tweet. Who gets custody of George Clooney? I don't know. Some tough love stories today here on Central Time.